From the earliest pages of the Scriptures, as we read about what Cain did to Abel, to the very end of the Scriptures, to the book of Revelation, how we read about what world political powers are going to do to the people of God, and everywhere in between, and especially reaching its zenith in the life of Jesus Christ, we read about episodes that leave us scratching our heads and saying, how can a man do that to another man? How can someone do that to another human being? And of course, whether we're reading the daily newspaper or we're looking at the Scriptures from cover to cover, we are observing therein the potential of mankind to overlook the value of human life and to not treat it with the sanctity that it deserves. The term sanctity speaks of holiness. In a related word, sacred means to reverence and to respect. And there's nothing in this world, certainly no other life form, and then most certainly beyond any other life form, there's nothing that deserves to be revered more than human life itself. The basis for the respect that ought to be given to another human being lies in the very creation of the human being by God. You would open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 1. And I'm finding as we're preaching from time to time on the subject of marriage and the family, you're beginning in Genesis 1. I guess Genesis is a pretty good word for the book. There are a lot of beginnings in the book of Genesis. And certainly from the opening pages, we read of the beginning of the earth itself and all other creation. We read of the beginning of man. We read of the beginning of relationship between man and woman. But one thing we read early in Genesis is that man is different. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. We find that physically speaking, man is related to the earth. In chapter 2, Moses goes on to explain that the body of man is fashioned from the dust of the ground, as is the body of animals. And God breathed into man and animal the breath of life. That is, we have a very similar principle of existence. That is, there are physical processes going on. God has set certain organs and tissues and other items within the body of man and animal that it may function biologically. So it's not in the human body that we find the distinction of man. It's in his inner being. It's in his spirit. That is what relates him to God. And if we can begin to understand and appreciate God as a spiritual being, hopefully in that consideration we will consider the spiritual being of man and come to appreciate the life that exists within another human being. Not the physical life. We don't agonize over the shooting of a deer when its physical life process ceases. We see that as food. If we're not careful, we'll see man and the death of a man as just the cessation of physical life processes and not understand more deeply what is going on when a man or a woman is killed. It is the spirit and the understanding of the spiritual essence of a human being that makes them different and makes our regard for that life different from other life. Turn back to Job 31, the passage of our reading this morning. Job 31, page 361 in the Pew Bible. I our understanding of the spiritual essence of human beings will greatly impact how we treat those human beings. And we see that even in the example of Job, which apparently is from the patriarchal age, from the earliest times of recorded human history is when Job lived. And what I want you to see out of the reading that we had this morning is what the motivation was for Job to treat his fellow human being in a humane way. We'll look back to verses 13 through 15, Job 31. If I have despised the cause of my manservant or my maidservant when they complained against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he punishes, how shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one fashion us in the womb? You see, Job is not measuring his manservant or his maidservant by their social status. Though they may be subservient to him, he does not see them as being less than a human being. In fact, it's his view of God that determines his view of his servants. And he says, I have endeavored in my life to treat those beneath me socioeconomically. It's been my desire to treat them right because we're both created of God. He goes on and talks further. If I have kept the poor, verse 16, from their desire, caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or eaten my morsel by myself so that the fatherless may not eat of it. But from my youth I reared him as a father, and from my mother's womb I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, any poor man without covering, etc., etc. Job is not merely refraining from murdering because of his view of the value of human life. He says, I'm obligated to treat people according to God's expectations, according to His standards of righteousness and justice. To understand that God is the creator of all and we share the spiritual imprint of God is the very foundation for society, and I suggest it's the foundation, the very basic foundation of marriage. We must learn to see the value and worth, to hallow or to revere or count sacred human life. Even human life that from a physical standpoint may not be perfect. Interesting observations made by God in Exodus chapter 4, page 40, Pew Bible. Exodus 4. This is when Moses is objecting to being selected and commissioned to go lead the Israelites out of Egyptian bondage. And even though he's talking face to face with God, it's almost like that makes no impression on Moses. But he hears this commission and he immediately, wait a minute. You've got the wrong guy. I'm not cut out for this, which is exactly what God was waiting to hear from Moses. Not a man who was so self-confident that he figured he can do this single-handedly, but the man who realized his human limitations and now is balking at this, well, that's the humility God is looking for. Moses takes it just a little bit too far in his objection. But in verse 10 of Exodus 4, Moses said to the Lord, Oh, my Lord, I'm not eloquent. Neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. So the Lord said to him, Who has made man's mouth? Or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I the Lord? We're living in a culture that is beginning to question the value of handicapped people. I don't mean to use that term in any negative way, just simply not able to physically function at optimum level, call it what you will, not a perfectly well-formed physical specimen. God is aware of defects in us, physically, and maybe even mentally, not maybe, absolutely mentally. God is aware of the defects, but He takes credit for the making of life. Because He sees beyond the physical and accounts for the spiritual reality and the integrity and the value of life. I made men. I understand their value, though maybe not formed perfectly. Ultimately, our lack of respect for God is what will lead us to devaluing man. If we appreciate and understand God, and we contemplate who He is as the Creator, as Job did, we will come to value human life. In Romans chapter 1, a lengthy passage which details the sins of the Gentile population throughout history, it's interesting to note that although Paul says in Romans 1 that God has demonstrated His divine nature and His divine power through creation, as Ronnie was even praying earlier this morning, he says, though God has manifested Himself in verse 21 of Romans 1, they knew God, but they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. They changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man. And guess what happens when you do that? What happens to your image of man? If you demote God from eternal spiritual creator to something made in the image of what He created, what do you think that does to mankind? Does it demote him or promote him? It demotes him. So, men exchange the truth of God for the lie, verse 25, worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator. It is blessed forever, amen. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. For even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one for another. Men with men committing what is shameful, receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which was due. Homosexuality strikes the very created nature of man and woman. And it has to do with a lack of respect for God as the Creator of each. They did not like to retain God in their knowledge, in verse 28, and God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things that are not fitting. And then look what flows from this rejection of God and a corruption of life created in God's image, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, whispers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, etc., etc. The failure to sanctify human life is a scourge not only on the face of the earth as a whole among unbelieving people, but can become the poison that contaminates marriages, that causes us not to treat our husband or our wife with the simple decency that we should because they are a human being. And in this lesson, we're talking about the very lowest foundation of relationship. There are other things to build on this that we'll be discussing later. But for this lesson, we're just simply trying to turn the spotlight on respect for human life and sanctifying the spiritual value of another human being being made in the image of God. So the roots of sanctity actually in the marriage, I think, finds its origin in Genesis 1, where God made man in His image. And that puts a premium on how I treat people, especially how I may treat my husband or my wife. Well, all around, of course, is evidence of a lack of sanctity in relation to marriage. And before we even get really to the subject of marriage, what I'd like to think about with you for a few moments is the lack of sanctity evident in wanting the fruits and benefits of marriage, that is a sexual relationship, apart from committing oneself to another human being because of respect for them and a desire to sanctify them as God would have us to do. When we talk about sexual relations outside of marriage, we're ultimately talking about selfish and sexual exploitation of another. Now, you can dress this up, you can perfume it, you can put flowers on it, you can make it appear to be whatever you want it to be. But sexual relations outside of marriage is simply selfishness, is what it is. You can speak romantically. You can add all other attachments to it. But at the end of the day, it's behavior that is ultimately directed toward one's selfish satisfaction. In fact, sometimes it's even overtly said, though I don't think there's an appreciation for what is being said, when a man, perhaps a younger man, but maybe not only, but is pressuring a younger woman to engage in such relations with him, he may use a line something like, "If you love me, you would really do this for me." To which the wise comeback is, "If you really love me and were concerned about me, you wouldn't ask me to do something like that." But it's an intensely selfish desire, sometimes even stated so, but cloaked with a sense of guilt and obligation to a young woman. "If you love me, you would do this." Well, a God-based view of a girlfriend or a prostitute, it doesn't matter. A God-based view of another human being should cause one to see that other person for their eternal value and their spiritual worth. One should not engage in privileges and in pleasures that God reserves for marriage and ties to lifelong commitment. One should not take those away from those parameters and exercise their selfish pleasures with another human being because it's another human being. And because there are emotional, psychological, and even physical consequences that can come from engaging in that behavior that will be disastrous for especially a young woman if a young man is engaged in this behavior only selfishly. The harm of fornication is just imprinted all over human history. In previous lessons, we've talked about the use and the rejection of Tamar by Amnon. Though the word, even in the Bible, used to describe what Amnon felt for her was love, all we have to do is read the episode and understand it wasn't love in the deepest sense. It was the objectifying of Tamar. She merely was an object of his personal gratification. Selfishness taken to the extreme, and once satisfied, he sends her away in humiliation. Thus, she and others like her go away from that kind of an encounter with the undermining of their healthy self-image. Fornication is the infliction of a lifetime of guilty memory. To so engage yourself with another human being in behavior that is outside the bounds of where God has placed it is to imprint on your mind a lifetime of memory for which you will feel guilty. And such is what results from this kind of behavior. It's not the outgrowth of love, but rather selfishness. It's the leading of a person further away from God. And that's why I said whether girlfriend or prostitute doesn't matter. To engage in this kind of behavior is to lead another soul away from God, not to mention yourself. I've often wondered, though the Scriptures don't give us perhaps a lot of insight into this, there was a lot of turmoil certainly in David's family, but I've often wondered what was the quality of David and Bathsheba's marriage after Uriah was killed and the baby born died. A relationship that was based on lust and forcible taking of another human being and then murdering an innocent man of higher character than even David had at that time. I wonder what the dynamics of that relationship were after that. Did they feel good about themselves? Did they feel comfortable with themselves? Did they enjoy a daily patter like nothing had ever happened? Knowing that Bathsheba's husband was in the grave because of David's lust? And then we have something connected with fornication. I'm going to take just a few minutes to talk about it. It's a subject that perhaps some is going to find very uncomfortable. But one of the natural products of sexual union is life. That is, this is the way God has provided for us to join with Him in the production of human life. And when a young man and young woman engage in sexual relations outside of marriage, the likelihood is very great that life is going to be produced. And in our society, when life is produced under those circumstances, often it is unwanted life. And so this failure to appreciate another human being, being made in the image of God, and to appreciate the spiritual value, to see and to sanctify this life as being created by God, thus to engage in fornication and not honor that life by committing yourself to that person, now is compounded. And a child is conceived. How does society generally react to this development? Does the respect for this life that grows out of disrespect for another life, does it go up? I don't want to burden you with statistics. They can be tedious. But I want to share just a few with you that I found in researching the lesson. 80% of women who have abortions are unmarried. That probably is not shocking to you, but did you know that it was that high? 80% of abortions are among women who are unmarried. That is, there's been already a disrespect for this other person, a disrespect being made in the image of God, and the marriage that grows out of the very creation itself, which we didn't talk about today, that we have in the past from Genesis 2. 2/3 of all abortions are among never married women. That is to say that 80% are unmarried might involve women who were married and then are no longer married and they have an abortion. 2/3 of all abortions are among never married women. What does that tell you? It tells you that young women are having abortions. 52% of women having them are younger than 25. Does this suggest to you that among young people in our country, of course, these statistics I'm sure would fit many Western societies, does it tell us that there's a great amount of sanctity for human life? Is that what these statistics are indicating without overly analyzing them? Is there respect and regard for human life in engaging in sexual relations with the strong possibility of producing life? Or is there sanctity of the life that may be produced in a circumstance that's not very convenient? No, there isn't sanctity for that life. It's being aborted. 1% of all abortions is attributed to rape and incest. The other 99% is due to consensual relations. And yet how often do we hear about rights? The rights of the woman because of rape and incest, and you're telling us that she's got a blah, blah, blah ad nauseum. It has nothing to do with rape and incest. It has everything to do with convenience. I don't want to be inconvenienced with human life. That's what this is about. Don't let people tell you anything different. It's about my life, and I don't want it interfered with, and I want to do with it what I want to do, and I don't care what it does to any other life, either the woman I've impregnated or the child that's now being carried by her. In further looking at some of the philosophical underpinnings of the abortion issue as we're facing in our nation, some of the research that I came up with said that 25% of the population of the United States strongly favors abortion, period. No debate, no ifs, ands, and buts, period. 25% strongly favor, 25% strongly oppose it. Strongly oppose it. Under no circumstances. should it be allowed? 50% of our population is ambivalent about abortion. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I don't think about it that much. Not that important to me. 80% of the 50% think that a fetus is a human baby. 80% of this category of the 50% that are ambivalent. 80% think the fetus is a human baby but say that abortion is a woman's right. What is that? It is a lack of sanctity of human life is what it is. I admit that it's a baby, but I think a woman's right to kill it and carry on with her life outweighs the human life. We have a horrendous view of the value of human life, not only illustrated by this. This is just one topic that related to the sanctity of human life in the family. This is just one expression of the lack of respect for human life that exists in our culture. And the danger that we face is letting this rub off on us, affecting the way that we live, the choices that we make, the way that we treat other human beings. But I'll tell you, these are, you know, some of these things are extreme examples. But turn to the book of James, chapter 3. We don't have to go to the extremes of murder and abortion and children born out of wedlock to demonstrate how the lack of appreciation for the spiritual being of a person may affect our behavior. Some of us, you know, may be sitting here thinking, well, you know, I understand what you're saying about all that, but I would never do that. James chapter 3, of course, is speaking about the tongue, how we speak to others, and the difficulty of controlling the tongue. Verse 8, no man can tame the tongue. It's an unruly evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Physical mistreatment often occurs within marriage, sometimes among Christians behind closed doors. But that's not the only way that we can demonstrate a lack of respect and a lack of sanctity for the one that we may be married to. Abuse often comes in the form of emotional or psychological mistreatment of another human being. And without raising a fist, words are going to be the vehicle whereby we abuse. And while screaming and cursing at our mate obviously violates various passages, 1 Colossians 4:6, let your speech always be with grace and seasoned with salt. While that kind of caustic and destructive speech certainly can tear down and destroy a person in a relationship, I think that our tongue can be mishandled in more subtle ways than that. I think we can corrode the self-worth and the perceived value of another human being by just constantly nagging and complaining in order to get our way. And sometimes we, you know, poke each other and we laugh and joke about the subject of nagging. And it's sort of become a standard, you know, joke in our society about the nagging that goes on in a marriage. But isn't there perhaps something a little bit deeper going on besides just a personality trait when that kind of manipulation is happening? Is it not that we're trying to force our will on someone else by verbal Chinese water torture? Just over and over and over. Maybe subtle, maybe never raising the voice, not screaming or yelling, not calling names, but just badgering until we get our way. Is that a godly response? Is that considering perhaps the other person as we should, or is it just being consumed with wanting to get our own way? Public criticism of our mate. It may not be that I resort to screaming and yelling behind closed doors, but well, I sure know where to jab them in public. And again, what's going on there? Well, even under the guise of humor, sometimes we're trying to send a message to our mate. We're trying to poke them in public, so what? So they'll think, I want them to understand how serious this is. I'm willing to say this in front of other people. I want other people to see my wife, my husband, the way I see them, and I want them to see that I have a justified right to fuss about this. So we're in public and we start jabbing each other. Perhaps smiling when we're doing it. You see what James is saying here? He's talking about our speech and how we speak to people relative to our being created in the image of God. How can we bless our God and Father out of one side of our mouth and curse those made in His image out of the other side? And again, can we violate this passage without actually cursing? Without screaming and hollering and demeaning? Can we not violate the spirit of what's being said here in other more subtle ways that perhaps characterize some marriages and some communication among husbands and wives? Well, as we close, if I could make some suggestions. That's not the second one. I don't know why two is there. It's actually the first one. We must instill sanctity for life in our children as we're raising them. This begins early. It begins among siblings. And I think there are some Christian parents that just think that fighting and fussing and carrying on amongst the children, that's just natural. Kids do that. May I ask you to rethink that? It does not have to be that way. It is not just a natural thing to let our children call each other names and mistreat each other and treat each other unjustly. Do you think they're going to draw a distinction between that and then how they play with their playmates? I doubt it, seriously. This is one of the earliest and most fundamental lessons that I believe we need to instill within children. How you view another human being. Let me tell you, in our society, we're seeing younger and younger and younger people doing unspeakably inhumane things to other young people. That tells me something isn't being taught at home. That there are people, whether they're 4, 5, or 6 years old, they're still people. And you must not speak that way to your brother, your sister, or your friends, especially to another adult. You do not speak that way. These are people created in the image of God. And however you get that point across, I think you can get it across to a young person. Other people are to be respected. But that won't help unless we're living it. You can't tell your child not to speak to their friends or their brothers and sisters that way when you're speaking to your wife that way. They're going to hear the example much more loudly than they're going to hear your words. And so we must be modeling this in front of our children. We must be living that respect for another human being. I tell you, in regard to divorce, I find myself asking the question quite often, how could one human being do that to another? How do you walk away when children are grabbing at your pants legs and screaming and hollering and saying, Daddy, don't go, or Mommy, don't go, but you walk away anyway? How do you do that? How do you leave people in your wake dissolve in tears and emotionally traumatized because this is the way you want to go in your life? I'll tell you how you do it. You harden yourself. You harden yourself to the responses of other human beings that will then allow you to walk away and do what you want to do because you don't really have any respect for sometimes your own children. You see, this respect for human life and sanctity of human life does not just come into play whether we're talking about physically abusing someone. It's the damage we inflict on them by the choices that we make, sometimes in our families. respecting human life and the sanctity of human life carries over into courtship. If we're not instilling this at a young age in our children, what's going to happen when they get to be in their mid to late teenage years and they begin to realize there are those of the opposite sex around and they become very interested in them and want to spend time with them? What's going to be the guarantee that they're going to control themselves as they should and treat their romantic interests over the course of time in a way that God would approve of? And just a word of advice or warning to those that are not yet married. If you're not being treated this way before you marry, if you're not being treated with sanctity and respect before you're married, chances are it will not change after you're married. If you can't demonstrate, or your boyfriend, girlfriend, fiance, if you can't demonstrate to them and them to you these qualities and traits before you marry, there's not a great likelihood that once the I do's are said, that's going to drastically improve. Some people make it easier to sanctify them because they are the kind of people God wants them to be. Look for those kinds of people to marry. Now, later on in other lessons, we'll talk about our obligations within marriage when things are not ideal. But look, the field is wide open before we marry. Before we say I do and before we're committed, we've got a world of opportunities. Don't settle. Don't talk yourself into settling for someone who is severely less than ideal and say somehow along the way we'll work that out. Look for someone that makes it easy for you to sanctify them because you can see spiritual character and godliness within them from the start. Develop an aversion to speaking derogatorily to or about your spouse. And I can say this because I think in my earlier married life I violated it. I think there were times in humor and whatnot, certain things were said about my wife or to my wife that shouldn't have been said. And I tell you, one of the most dangerous things in this regard is a quick wit. Because a witty person will often go for the laugh, you know, and the punchline comes to them like that. And before you know it, you say it and everybody's ha-ha and you get a little charge out of that quick wit. You need to be careful about that. You need to be careful how you speak to and about your mate and make it an aversion to saying things that are negative. If there's a negative situation that needs to be dealt with, find a better way to deal with it than to make it a personal undermining of that other person. Do not compromise natural affection for your children. In our day and time, perhaps it's very easy to do. We're busy. We've got competing interests. And so often in our society, we see children taking a back seat to many other priorities. But again, I think in our society is to not even be able to see children for their spiritual worth and not be able to appreciate the image of God that is imprinted within them. And we read the newspaper and see what people are doing even to innocent and helpless children. It suggests the depravity, perhaps, of the society that we live in as a whole. But we're not exempt from that temptation. Christians have walked out on their families, again, leaving their children in great emotional distress because there just isn't the kind of due consideration given to those children that should be. There must be a willingness on our part to sacrifice and to endure, fulfill God's purposes for us in marriage and in parenthood. But in this lesson, the focus is simple. There are just some things we don't have the right to do to another person. We don't have the right to treat life the way that so often our society is being treated. And so as we close, I'll just simply ask you to meditate on the question, do you respect human life as God has made it? And that may begin with yourself. Do you respect yourself? And do you see yourself in the context of a being created by God and therefore of intrinsic value? And are you demonstrating that appreciation for the value of yourself by pursuing a life of godliness, a life of obedience before God that will result in eternity in your spiritual well-being? If that's not the case, then perhaps on reflection you think that you don't even view yourself with the value that you should, and you want to know where to find that, we would direct you to the Lord and to His sacrifice for you and for all men, thereby instilling, or reinstilling perhaps, this image of God put within man and the value and the preciousness with which God holds all human life. It begins with an understanding of that sacrifice and a response to it, committing yourself to Christ in view of that great sacrifice. Would you like to do that this morning? We'll help you as we stand and sing.